In December of last year, we reviewed the history and the prophecy of a strange-sounding subject or topic. Well, I don't think I'm the only one, but even after all of these years and reading and studying and looking at what we have in the Bible, it still seems as though the beast seems like an unusual subject from the Bible. And when you add in the mark of the beast, I think it just sounds a little bit more unusual. I try sometimes to look at it from the viewpoint of somebody that's not as familiar with the Bible as you are. But I would just say that, wow, if you told people that the beast was a major topic of the Bible, they'd wonder what you were talking about. So in this congregation, though, I think we have thoroughly covered the difficulty in knowing a lot of detail. And I've really cautioned about trying to nail this down, the detail of future events, so that you get so specific that, you know, you might get boxed in somehow and you might get tied to this, because I've seen that happen. And that's the reason I give that kind of warning. I've seen that happen in nearly 50 years in the church. People kind of get boxed into their own theories and ideas and circumstances, and then that kind of falls apart. And it's kind of what happened to the Seventh-day Adventists in 1844 with their wrong theory about the 2300 days prophecy. And when that didn't come to pass from then on, and then the offshoots, not just the offshoots, but the Church of God, and it had its, the people of God, or the Seventh-day Adventists, shall I say, had their origin in the Church of God and broke away. And we've covered some of that history, and I don't want to go through all that again. But then from that point on, when in 1860, the Church of God once again emerged as a group of people who were keeping the Sabbath day, they didn't want to have anything to do with Bible prophecy. Such was the effect of the failed prophetic utterances of Mrs. White and her husband and all that happened with the Seventh-day Adventists. So the research that I'd like to share with you today was never written in any of our publications, didn't appear in article form, but it was a topic that was studied and documented by one of our writers of the Good News and Plain Truth magazine, Mr. Keith Stump. And at least in the introduction today, I'd like to acknowledge his great work many, many years ago on that particular, on the topic that I'm going to address today. That's the basis of the sermon. One of the questions that arise when you're studying the future, and Bible prophecy does provide us a window into the future, one of the questions is, getting back to this desire to know details, is who will be the principals of these future events? Who will be those individuals? And at one time, I think some of you have been around long enough to know that we did have some identification with those individuals. And we kind of forecast, you know, that guy, he looks like he might be the guy. He might be the one. Now, we didn't say it in that way. I'm making fun of it in a way to kind of try to limit and hopefully limit your desire to do that same kind of thing. And that's not just with individuals, but a lot of different little things that happen. Don't get tied into something. It's going to box you in, and then if it doesn't happen, oh, wow, how disappointed you might be, just like the advent of 1844. So it's only natural curiosity, though, to want to know who those individuals will be. But unfortunately, I cannot specify some of those to you in that kind of detail. But this is what I can do for you today. I can give you an outline of the past and thereby provide you a window to the future. Okay? How's that? Some of you like history. Some of you are, oh boy, another snore time for me. No, I don't think it will be. I don't think you should be interested in it. Should be. Let's see if you are. The title is, this is a little bit of a different title, so it's got a lot of similarities to some things that we've talked about in the past. Who will be the beast? That's a question I can't answer, by the way, but it's still a question. That's the title. Who will be the beast? So I can't tell you who the individual will be, but it does sound strange, does it not, to label a person as a beast? Yeah, that's, to me, unusual. The past helps us frame the future. And today, what I'd like to present to you are 10 similarities that were present in the known last six heads of the Roman Empire, the Holy Roman Empire, from the time of 554 until the middle of the 20th century. Those last six heads. Now, there's seven, because one hasn't appeared on the scene. But to know who that individual is really impossible. You're not going to know today, so forget about that. But there are some similarities of virtually all of these 10 similarities were part of the last six, what are called resurrections of the Holy Roman Empire. And they're tied in with Bible prophecy and with the past as well. So if the past is any guide, you may be able to use these 10 similarities that help identify those previous six heads of the Holy Roman Empire. Now, this kind of gets confusing. Have you got your beast charts handy? Any of you bring your beast charts with you? Any of you got one of these? You don't have one? I got you covered. I got some extras. You have to come and see me. And I don't expect you to carry that around like it's the Holy Grail or something you must have on your possession at all times. But it helps you to understand. So I'll give some of the, in framing all of this, I'll give you a little bit of a brief review. As the events of the future develop, this is important for you. It may be important for your kids. You have it? Good. That's it. You got it. It's got to sound strange, you know, when somebody listens to the CD or online, you know, those of you. I'm interacting with the audience, those of you in El Paso. We do this a little bit more informally there in El Paso, but at any rate, as the events of the future develop, all or most of these tendencies or characteristics are likely to be present in the end time fulfillment of the beast, he said dramatically. Turn to Daniel chapter 2. Daniel chapter 2. We'll begin there. You're going to have everything you need today for an outline of this particular topic. You're going to have it. You're going to have it down so well, or you're going to be utterly confused. It's going to be either or. It may be somewhere in between. Daniel chapter 2 begins the description of these prophetic beasts. And Daniel was there from the beginning of this description. And he was inspired to describe the first four ruling kingdoms that were shown in a dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. And what Nebuchadnezzar saw in that dream wasn't just a beast. It was a symbol. It was a man. It may have been the image of him himself, standing tall on the plains of Babylon. Turn to Daniel 2 and in verse 31, Daniel describes this dream. You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. It had a head. So obviously it was a human image. Its image head was fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. In verse 37, it says, For you, O King of kings, for the God of heavens has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of the heaven, he has given them into your hand, and he has made you ruler over them all. you are this head of gold. Oh, you know, honey, I should have brought that picture that Larry did for me many years ago in Rapid City. I've got that whole thing. I could have had it here as a little kind of old school kind of help. Yeah, maybe we'll bring it someday. It's very nice. Gave it to me as a going away gift when we left Rapid City. One of the artists there did a very nice representation of this. Verse 39, but after you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours. Then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over the earth. And a fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. Whereas you saw the feet and the toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. Yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. And as you saw iron mixed with the ceramic clay, they will mingle with the seed of men. But they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. It won't be a perfect match, this last representation of kingdom. And in the days of these kings... So this image represents kings. In the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. Showing us that this image would be present at the time of Christ's return. It depicts four successive ruling kingdoms and kings that are described. And we aren't the only ones that understand this. Historians through history after the time of, you know, ancient historians understood that this had happened in history and identified. Historians such as Herodotus identified these kingdoms. Babylon the first, then Persia, then Greece, and then finally, Rome, this last with two legs, denoting east and west. At least we think so. And Rome is the one that is destroyed at the return of Jesus Christ. Now, the height of the Roman Empire, the very height, now it lasted, some people say, for 1,000 years from like, you know, approximately 500 BC to 500 AD to the beginning of Rome with Romulus, all the way up to the fall of the Roman Empire in 476 AD. So about, you know, that's the idea that the Roman Empire lasted that long. But it was at its height from 31 BC until 476 AD. So Daniel 7, going on a few chapters later, describes this beast, this last one, this one that even ancient historians identified as Rome, describes this beast as having 10 horns in Daniel 7 and in verse 7. And I saw, and this I saw in the night visions, behold, a fourth beast, the last one that is described, you know, the lower part of this image that was in the dream. A fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth, and it was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. 10 horns. Now, those of you that have your beast charts, don't be too distracted by looking at all of this now. But if you'll turn to verse 23, it says, thus he said, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which shall be different from all other kingdoms. It shall devour the whole earth, trample it and break it in pieces. The 10 horns are 10 kings who shall arise from this kingdom and shall arise after them, and another shall arise after them, and he shall be different from the first ones, and he shall subdue 3 kings. So this is the same thing that is spoken of in Revelation. Hold your place there in Daniel, but turn over to the book of Revelation. And I'll try to pause and remember my wife's kind yet stern advice to slow myself down a little bit. I have a tendency to move fast and get excited. This is the same thing that is mentioned in Revelation 13. The same exact beast. Then I stood on the sand of the sea, verse 1, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his horns 10 crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous name. And then in verse 7, it was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them, and all authority was given to him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. In Revelation 13 and verse 3, it says that I saw one of these heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world marveled and followed the beast. Now, Daniel 7 describes what happens next in history with three horns. Verse 8, three horns. Then this little horn that comes up, Daniel 7 and verse 8. I was considering the horns, wondering about that, Daniel was, and there was another horn, a little horn, coming up from among them, before whom three of the first horns, so horns 1, 2, 3, were plucked up by the roots. And there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words. In this horn is described as plucking up these first horns, this little horn. So Daniel 7 describes what would happen next in history, because these three horns that are mentioned in verse 8 were kind of a part of that Roman Empire, but they weren't Roman. These were invading hordes, successive hordes that came into Rome and caused Rome to fall at the time period 476 AD. The Vandals, you guys got these memorized, don't you? The Vandals, the Heruli, and the Ostrogoths. And they covered a period where they dominated the Roman Empire, invading hordes from the north, Germanic tribes that came down, and others that came down, ransacked Rome, defeated Rome. And then history shows us a remarkable event that occurs next. And that is the advent of a church, of all things, exercising its religious and its political might. And this church was based in Rome. This church had become influential through the first 400 years of history from 31 AD. No, not the Church of God. What happened to the church is that it was hijacked. The Christian church was hijacked, and things were done differently than were done by the founding apostles. And when you examine the history of this church and the origins of this church, it's nothing like the Church of Jerusalem or the church at Antioch. It's transformed. It's totally different. It's not keeping the Sabbath. It's not keeping the holy days. It's unrecognizable in terms of Christianity, but indeed, it did happen. And you know what this church did? It copied everything about that Roman system. It copied its government, it copied its grandeur, and tried to recapture all the splendor of that Roman Empire, which had fallen in 476 AD. And although you had three horns that came in, and history records them as coming in, ransacking, ruling over Rome at that particular time, the church saw that this was wrong. And in Revelation chapter 13, Revelation 13, the breach in the line of this beastly powers is now healed. Revelation 13, told you to keep your place there, and I didn't keep my place. Verse 5, and he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue for 42 months. The breach in this line, which had been shown to be wounded, in verse 3, it says, I saw one of the heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world marveled. This covers thousands of years, not just one event, not just one occurrence, but over thousands of years. This particular beast would continue at various times through history. And that wound that had been caused by the invading tribes of the north, the Vandals, the Heruli, and the Ostrogoths, causing the fall of that Roman Empire, was healed. This time, for the first time in history, in 554 AD, there was now a union of church and state. Now, to the American ear, this is such a foreign terminology, a union of church and state, because we threw that off at the founding of this nation, even before there was any constitution. With the arrival of the pilgrims, there wasn't going to be any union of church and state. And then that continued for the next 150 years or so until the writing of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. Because the experience of our founding fathers and their understanding of the development of Christian thought was rife with the information that a union of church and state would have and always had had disastrous consequences for people who just didn't conform. People who didn't conform. Why do you think that they were so zealous in protecting religious freedom and worship in this country? They're a lot closer to that ancient history that had taken place. And the martyrdom of the Middle Ages that took place under the auspices of this church, which began to rise in political and military might, beginning in 554 AD. And some estimates put the martyrdom of people who would not conform to that religious power that arose again in 554 AD, upwards of 50 million people, including people of God, including Jews, including Sabbath keepers who may not have been a part of God's truth, including other people who may have worshiped on Monday but didn't want to bow to Rome. That was a lot more embedded in the conscience of our pilgrims and founding fathers as they wrote those words which would outline our history. We have a church that rose as a political power beginning in 554 AD. And this is what the founding fathers wanted to avoid. The persecution of people and their beliefs that had taken place in the not so distant past of their lives. So the revival of the Roman Empire began in 554 under Justinian the Great. This is the first of seven remaining horns that Sheila and some others have with them today. You're a good Bible student. You keep these things. Very good. No, I'm just kidding. That makes everybody else feel guilty for not having it, right? Justinian was the first emperor of a restored Rome, and he recognized the church. And I'll read from a renowned encyclopedia on the internet, Wikipedia. Most of the time they get things pretty right. You like Wikipedia, right? Okay. Could have found something else in Encyclopedia Britannica or one of the others. But during his reign, Justinian sought to revive the empire's greatness and reconquer the lost western half of the historical Roman Empire. Justinian was from the east. Justinian's rule constitutes a distinct epoch in the history of the later Roman Empire, and his reign is marked by the ambitious but only partly realized renovate imperii, or the restoration of the empire. But as you'll see, the vision was grandiose, and that's what they wanted to conquer. This was the first of five heads, beginning with Justinian. All right, name them off with me now. Charlemagne, right? Otto the Great. I wouldn't be able to do it if I didn't have my notes, okay? So just be honest. Charles the Fifth, or Charles the Great, and then Napoleon. Now, turn to Revelation chapter 17. Revelation 17 and verse 10 takes us up to the time, at least we think, of Napoleon. But remember, a lot of these prophecies can last for thousands of years, end abruptly. But this is what it says in verse 10. There are also seven kings. Five have fallen. These are the five heads of the Holy Roman Empire. One is, and the other is not yet come. So you have seven total revivals from 554. Got it? We've had five. We've had Justinian the Great, Charlemagne the Great, Otto the Great, Charles the Great, and finally Napoleon. The Holy Roman Empire and its martyrdoms and its conquests were eventually defeated. The forces of the Holy Roman Empire were defeated in 1814 at Waterloo. Napoleon was the last. He was the last to be, well, he wasn't the last to be defeated, but he was defeated at that particular time. And then in history, there is a respite. There is a respite. There's no domination of church and state anymore, which had gone from 554 all the way to 1814, a period of 1,260 years exactly. There's a respite in history. And guess who appears on the scene to dominate? The English-speaking peoples of the world. Guess what? They still dominate. You may not think so. For a long time, we thought, oh, the end in 1972, you know, we're going to diminish, blah, blah, blah. We were wrong, see? Because the English-speaking peoples of the world still encircle the world. The United States is the most powerful nation in the world. Yeah, China's coming up. China's not mentioned specifically a lot in Bible prophecy. It's becoming a danger. I mean, look where they're going all through the world. It's an amazing thing, going through Africa, going through South and Central America, lending money to these developing nations, tying up their natural resources. But none of that is mentioned in Bible prophecy. It's an interesting thing, and I think you should study it. It's not really specifically mentioned via Bible prophecy, which indicates, as important and powerful as that nation is becoming with its billions of people, look how much more powerful, if you believe Bible prophecy, this kingdom will become. More influential, more powerful than we can believe. The sixth head did kind of arise. The sixth head of these final seven did kind of arise because there was an individual by the name of Garibaldi, and he reunited Italy. Now, it doesn't mean that every restoration of this power, this empire, ruled the entire world. Doesn't mean that. Bible doesn't indicate that. Garibaldi certainly didn't dominate world events, but along with the rise of the English-speaking peoples of the world, inserted into that time period is this kind of unification of Italy, which was fragmented all over the place, you know, parts in Switzerland, parts in Italy, parts governed by France, parts governed by the Austro-Hungarian Empire, etc., etc. This guy Garibaldi left Italy and he went down to South America. And he studied there for a while. He taught. But in 1847, there was a new pope. Pope Pius IX was elected as pope. And he had a vision of unifying Italy. He had a vision of a powerful union of state and church. And Garibaldi wrote to him and he said, if these hands used to fighting would be acceptable to His Holiness. Now think about it. Here's a guy writing to a church leader saying, look, I can use my hands, which are used to fighting, and I can work for you. The church in fighting can do it. And he did. And he united Italy in 1870. We most thankfully dedicate them, his hands, to the service of Him who deserves so well of the church and of the fatherland. Joyful indeed shall we and our companions in whose name we speak be, if we may be allowed to shed our blood in defense of Pius IX's work of redemption. You see the synergy there? And this guy came back, and the Pope was accepting of his work, and it happened. Italy was reunified, became kind of a dictatorship under Mussolini, and actually Hitler reigned over the final phase of this particular sixth head. And then the Axis powers, Italy, Germany, defeated. And what was their goal? What was their goal of the world in the mid-century of the 20th century? We'll get to that. You'll see it. You know what it is. You know what their end time goal was, their end goal was. So the question remains, who will be the beast? There are 10 characteristics that I'll close with you today, because history can show us the patterns of human behavior that, along with the broad outline of prophecy, can help us to at least understand some of the things that could be a part. I'm not going to say all 10 of these have to happen, but I'm going to say this. They could be a helpful guide, and I'm only giving this to you because they could be a helpful guide to your own study, and you can take a look at some of these things and that which interests you, and those of you that are computer literate, if you can turn it on, you're one step ahead, okay? If you can find somehow the internet, you're another step ahead. If you know what a browser is, you know what? You can go down to the local library, and then you're just going to have to take a little bit more time with things. You're going to have to go to a book on a shelf and bring it off and take it back to the table, turn on the lamp, and read. I know that sounds like a chore, doesn't it? So learn how to be computer literate. That's the Just kidding. All of the last of these heads, these six heads, have had these common characteristics. Number one, classical imitation or inspiration. What does that mean? Classical imitation or inspiration. There has been a desire from 554 of all of these kings, beasts, kingdoms to recapture this lost glory and lost grandeur of Rome and to copy it and to replicate it. There's been a fascination with the Roman government, the ancient Roman government, a desire to imitate that system. In fact, the system, the Roman system, was imitated from its hierarchy and its government by the Roman church. Classic inspiration and domination, and copied virtually that Roman system, made it their own, and added religion to it under the facade of religion. Napoleon said, I am from a race of Caesars. He was named by the Pope the King of Rome at his coronation. Do you know what his favorite type of clothing was, that is, of Napoleon? Little known fact. The toga. The Roman toga. That's what he loved. Mussolini greatly admired, as an Italian, greatly admired Rome. He had dreams of grandeur. In 1936, he proclaimed his kingdom as a revival of the Holy Roman Empire, then entered into an axis with the Germans, of course. If you've seen the old newsreels of Hitler's rallies, you remember those? You've seen them. A frightening thing to see, but it's an imitation of the Roman system with the crowds and the hordes and the people repeating after this maniacal speech is given and the people saluting Heil Hitler. It was a copy of the Roman system. So we might expect that whoever is that beast or that leader of that last revival of the Holy Roman Empire to be someone that looks backwards to the style of the Roman system. You don't see that today. It's not there. It's not there. It's not happening right now. Point number two. The goal of establishing a far-reaching, worldwide dominating empire. All the previous restorations have sought to have influence, as Rome did for 1,000 years, over many countries and peoples. Many countries. In fact, as far as they could go, all over the whole world. That's what the desire of the Roman Empire has been in its various incarnations, its various revivals. They've wanted to establish over a large geographical area one ruler, one law, one church. That is what we see occurring in Bible prophecy, Revelation 13 and Revelation 17. Each of the six heads of the healed Roman Empire have sought worldwide domination. Now, have they always had it? No. But Revelation chapter 13 and verse 4 says, "So they," which is the world in the previous verse, "so they worship the dragon," so it will happen in the time of the end, the final resurrection of that empire. "They worship the dragon who gave authority to the beast. They worship the beast, saying, 'Who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him?'" Well, obviously, no one. Verse 14, "He deceives those who dwell on the earth." This is the little horn of spoken of by Daniel, the other beast in verse 11. "That deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast." This is the false prophet telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image of the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. He was wounded by the sword, overtaken in 476 AD, restored in 554, and various resurrections of that period of time. In verse 16, it says, "He causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark in their right hand and on their foreheads." All through the whole world. Domination of the world. We don't see that happening at this particular time. The third similarity that all of these have had is authoritarian rule. Now, again, authoritarian rule is something that is foreign to the concept of Americans. Authoritarian rule, except in some households, like mine, where I rule with an iron fist. I tell my kids and my wife what they're going to do before they even think about it. No, I don't. They tell me what to do. No. We have a very democratic system in our household. My vote counts for a half share. Everybody else is full. Mark 10, I'm just kidding. They know who's boss. Don't you kid yourselves. Mark 10 and verse 42. "The way men have ruled over men, the way Rome ruled over Palestine at the time of Christ's life, and the way in which his disciples were ruled by a foreign power. In verse 42, Jesus called to them to himself and said, "You know that those who are considered rulers over the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them." You're taught what to think, what to do. You can't do much unless they allow it. Authoritarian rule, that is the way the Gentiles ruled. That is the way the Roman system has ruled. And Christ recognized this. And rarely, if ever, has this kind of power been used in a benevolent way. Almost never. Throughout the annals of history, Revelation chapter 17 and verse 13 speaks of this kind of power given to one individual. Revelation 17 and verse 13. "These are of one mind," that is, 10 kings, "who will give their power and authority to the beast." To the beast. Not enlightened. Old school authoritarian rule. That is the way much of the world is ruled today, as a matter of fact. And we've got a shockingly ignorant political base of millennials today who think socialism, oh, that's so wonderful. Socialism, that's the way to go. Free everything for everybody, free health care, free college education, free this, free that. Boy, oh boy, we're going to make it good for you because we're going to take it from all those rich people. We're going to take it all. Take it all from them, give to you. The Robin Hoods of modern society. Oh, the savior of the people. You know what happens? It always goes back this way. Authoritarian rule. That's socialism. One man. The people, well, obviously, we're all equal here, but, you know, I'm more equal, so because I've done so much for all of you and getting you, oh, wait a minute, you're not as well off as you used to be because all this stupid socialism. Well, besides that, let's ignore that fact. Authoritarian rule. The beast will be a dictator. He will rule with one-man domination. And as we see in Revelation 13 and 17, his power is going to be inspired by demonic forces. The fourth point, papal collaboration. Now, this does not mean, nor has it ever meant, if you've been misled to believe this, then I'm here to correct it for you today. Papal collaboration, that is the collaboration between church and state, has not always been a rosy picture of, hey, we're all real good buddies here. You know, we love the church loves us, yada, yada, yada. No, it hasn't been that way. These dictators have often fought with the people that they've had the unification with. But there's been a stormy relationship with most of the revivals that I've mentioned. So if you look up Justinian on Wikipedia or Encyclopedia Britannica, you'll see sometimes it's just a loose affiliation, but there's an affiliation with the church nonetheless in all of these revivals. Christ said in Matthew chapter 12, Matthew chapter 12, and in verse 26, "If Satan casts out Satan, he is divided against himself. How then will his kingdom stand?" Well, Satan's kingdom is sometimes divided against itself. And this will be his kingdom rising up in the seventh revival of the Holy Roman Empire, make no doubt about it. In 800 AD, Charlemagne was crowned by Pope Leo, a concordant with the state. In 1520, Charles V was crowned ruler of the Holy Roman Empire by Pope Clement. And Mussolini entered into a concordant with the church along with Germany in 1933. And I say this jokingly, Ellis, I hope you're able to watch today. His buddy, the designated successor to the Holy Roman Empire, Ellis's friend, his buddy, Otto von Habsburg. Yeah, you don't believe me? Go into his study. There's a picture of him on the G3 flitting off to New York, planning their takeover of the world. No, just kidding. He came from that family, Otto von Habsburg. We had a nice chat about it. Ellis knows when I'm joking, don't you, Ellis? Okay. His friend, descendant of the Holy Roman Empire, which I've described as being exceedingly vicious throughout history, was one of Ellis's friends. Remember that, okay. He'll be back sometime to defend himself, I'm sure, but hopefully you got a little laugh out of that. But he was a gentle, kind soul, really, when you get down to it, so he wasn't the beast. But he said this, a European culture without its Christian heritage is unthinkable. That's what he had been taught as a good Catholic. Although the church will confirm the authority of the beast, you can read that in Revelation 17:16. It also shows, maybe we want to turn there, it also shows that eventually the church is going to be hated. Revelation 17 and verse 16, they've had this kind of loose affiliation, not a closeness necessarily, but together, they've been together through history. Revelation 17 and verse 16, and the 10 horns which you saw on the beast, these will hate the harlot, the woman, make her desolate and naked, eat her flesh and burn her with fire. Now, interestingly, there's probably a vision of demons that was given to Pope Pius X in 1909, but he had this horrifying dream. You can look it up. He had this horrifying dream that the last pope would walk out of the Vatican over the dead bodies of all of his priests. Now, it's a hideous prophecy, but probably one that is inspired by other forces. The fifth common denominator, German domination. German domination. Yeah, that's right. All through history, German domination in terms of the political head. The pattern of the government was Rome, but it was carried on in history by Germans. Now, they picked something up, I guess, with their invasion of Rome in the 400s AD. Justinian, the first of these heads, was thought to be Greek, but he's actually an Illyrian. That's Illyrian. And he comes from a stock of people who had been conquered by Germanic tribes many centuries earlier than him. And some historians have simply concluded that his proper name of his family was Teutonic, or German in origin, very likely of German blood. Now, not a huge issue, not a huge point. You know, we're not going back and doing a 23andMe test and blood test of anything, or DNA sampling or anything like that, but it is interesting. All these roads lead back to Germany in terms of the leaders. Charlemagne was a German Frank. And of course, Otto the Great, he was German of the Austrian Habsburg dynasty, the Austrian Germanic dynasty. They were of Germanic origin. There's a Germanic legend that the last emperor of Europe will be another Charles. It's a tradition. There is a Catholic prophecy says that the last pope will be Peter the Roman. So you might be looking for an Italian pope and a Germanic beast at the time of the end. Could be very likely happen in that way. I'm not saying it. Karl der Große, or Charles the Great, his capital was in Aachen, Germany. And Napoleon, oh, he's French, you say. Wait a minute, French. This guy's French. He was born on Corsica. He did not speak French until he was 10 years old. His family has been traced back to the 11th century Florentine Italy, which was settled as a Lombard duchy, which was a Germanic tribe, conquered northern Italy and settled there. He was a German Lombard. If nothing else, it's all an interesting coincidence. In 1806, Napoleon crowned himself the Iron Crown with the Iron Crown of Lombardy. And of course, moving on from Garibaldi and Mussolini, Hitler is the one that dominated the Sixth Revival at the end, which began with Garibaldi. In Isaiah chapter 10, and in verse 5, we can probably conclude that the final beast will also be of Germanic stock. Isaiah 10 and verse 5 says, "Woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger, and the staff in whose hand is my indignation. I will send him against an ungodly nation and against the people of my wrath, and I will give him charge to seize the spoil, to take the prey, and to tread them down like mire in the streets. Yet he does not mean so, nor does his heart think so, but it is in his heart to destroy and cut off not a few nations." That has been a tendency of Germany at various times through history. By the way, did I mention that Mr. Tannert will be speaking next week? He agrees with this, by the way. I just did that for a laugh. Sorry. Cheap laugh, my bad. Number 6, involvement with the Middle East, and most of the time with the Arab Middle East. Similarity that all of these empires have had is a fascination with the Middle East, beginning with Justinian, who had Eastern wars into Persia and later signed a peace treaty with them. Charlemagne was friendly with an individual by the name of Harun al-Rashid, the Caliph of Baghdad, who was the ruler of the Islamic world at that particular time. Charles V courted the favor of Suleiman the Magnificent, whom you've probably heard about. And in 1798, Napoleon led a campaign into the Middle East. He courted Islamic favor as well. He publicly honored the Prophet Muhammad. Mussolini invaded Libya, marched into Tripoli, and then later on, Hitler, as we know, tried to drive into Palestine. But the forces of Rommel were repelled, right? Mainly the British forces, some American forces as well. Prophecy shows, note this, Psalm 83. Prophecy shows that Assyria will be allied with Arab nations against modern Israel. So we have it there once again. Psalm 83, verse 1, "Do not be silent, O God. Do not hold your peace, and do not be still, O God, for behold, your enemies make a tumult, and those who hate you have lifted up their head. They have taken crafty counsel against your people." You see that phrase in the Bible, it's speaking of Israel. "And consulted together against your sheltered ones, they have said, come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be remembered no more. For they have consulted together with one consent. They form a confederacy against you." This indicates that at the time of the end, the Islamic world, the Arab world, if you will somehow come together, even though there are various factions that hate each other today of Islam. This indicates that at one point in the future, they'll resolve those rifts and form a confederacy against you, the tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites, Moab and the Hagarites, Gebel, Ammon and Amalek, Philistia with the inhabitants of Tyre. Assyria also has joined with them they have helped the children of Lot. That is an end time prophecy. And it's certainly been something that has taken place throughout history. Point number 7, British opposition. The British have always been at odds with the Gentile revivals of the Holy Roman Empire. Now you can take a look at Napoleon, who desperately wanted to conquer England, but was defeated at the Battle of Trafalgar by Admiral Nelson. Going all the way back to Caesar, he invaded Britain, but emergencies called the Roman legions back to Rome because of some problems, and then the Angles and the Saxons moved into England. Not too long ago, it was thought, I don't give too much credence to this, but in the 80s, instead of traveling across from France to England in hovercraft, which they do, they built what they called the Channel, from France to England. So people thought, that's the way they'll invade. They'll invade England that way someday in the future. Well, I don't know if that's going to make it easier or if it really matters, but they're connected that way. Point number 8. Turn to Revelation chapter 13. Point number 8. And you can check this out, you internet warriors. Take a look. Fill in the blanks yourself. Do a little historical research. Point number 8, an association with the occult. The Holy Roman Empire and its revivals have always had a fascination with occult powers. And in Revelation 13 and verse 2, it says, "Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a lion, a bear, his mouth like the mouth of a lion. Then the dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority." I don't think that power was necessarily wielded in a great way in times past, but there's always been that association. Going back to ancient Rome, there was a tremendous interest in the occult in Rome. That was the religion of Rome, the occult. They had horoscope readings back then. Yes, they did. Caesar Augustus would not step outside until he had his horoscope read to him that day by the mediums that were in his court. Emperor Justinian and his wife are described by their associates as demons in human bodies. One servant of Justinian the Great claimed to have seen a strange form entering the king's body while he was asleep in his chambers. This is the kind of thing that gives you a little kind of chills, You don't want to spend a lot of time on this, by the way. Charlemagne had his occult advisors, and many claimed that he had an unusual clairvoyance and ability to predict the outcome of events. The court secretary and advisor to Charles V was a magician. Interesting. Napoleon and his wife Josephine believed in fortune-telling. They had tarot cards. They loved that stuff. Had numerous mystical experiences in life. They, in visiting the king's chamber at the Great Pyramid in Egypt, saw a spiritual message emanate. They consulted with an Egyptian soothsayer while they were there. And then Otto the Great, Hitler, and Mussolini all had their astrologers as well. This probably is not going to shock you if you've studied World War II history at all. The Nuremberg trials, they asked the generals, the people that they condemned to death for their war crimes, how they could do what they did and why they listened to this maniacal Führer. And they said almost with one voice, "You haven't seen the Führer in his fury." They were describing something that was otherworldly that took place. Hitler's advisors claimed that at times strange forces would overtake him. And if you watch enough of his speeches, you can see it. Daniel chapter 8 and verse 23, the King James renders this pretty clear, but I'll read it in the New King James because I've kind of gotten used to the New King James. But Daniel chapter 8 indicates that this would be a trait. In verse 23, in the latter time of their kingdoms, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise having fierce features who understands sinister schemes. The King James says dark sentences. Some commentators feel that this refers to occult powers. In Revelation 16 and verse 13, I'll cite this one for lack of time, which shows unclean spirits coming out of the beast. And of course, we know that we fight against the prince of the power of the air. The last revival of the Holy Roman Empire is going to be the last shot of Satan the devil for mankind in this age. So we can be sure that these previous six revivals have been a forerunner of what is going to happen in the future. Vatican Hill, by the way, in the Latin, means a place of divination. Yeah. Number nine, crisis exploitation. History has shown that the revivals of the Holy Roman Empire and their individuals have been masters at exploiting a crisis in order to seize power. Now, the evolution of the common market to the European Union has been devoid of crisis, lo, these last seven decades. It has been gradual. It has been normal. It has been a union that is not complete yet, of course. But it has not had any real crisis since its establishment in 1954. Otto the Great emerged as a deliverer. And before Napoleon came on the scene, there was terror and revolution in France that he was able, as a strong leader, to take advantage of. And, of course, the collapse of the economic system in Italy and in Germany was something that Hitler and Mussolini were able to take advantage of and rise to power because of. But today, good times in Europe, happy times. Oh, they don't like Britain leaving. In Britain, will they leave? Who knows? But there's peace and prosperity in Europe. The conditions are not urgent enough for a strong man to rise. So you can look for a crisis to develop and that individual to rise at that particular time. And then finally, divine intervention. Divine intervention. All of this is going to be ended by divine intervention, the intervention of God. All this stuff is dark and it's creepy and it's horrible, but it's going to be dark and creepy, so don't be mad at me for just explaining what the Bible says or just covering these scriptures. It's going to be dark and creepy in the future. And if we live to that time, we're going to go through some darkness and creepiness and horrible stuff. In Daniel chapter 2 and verse 21, it says, he changes the times and seasons, that is God. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. In speaking of the empire of beasts, it specifically says that they can go only so far. Only so far as God allows them. And Isaiah 10 also shows that God is going to intervene in the events of man when Christ returns to set up his kingdom. So it's always going to end and always has ended in God ending the whole thing, which he did at one point, so that the United States and British peoples could claim their heritage and have for the last couple of hundred years. Now, one last, let me be clear to label this as far-reaching speculation and idle thinking and nothing more. You got that? The fall of Babylon was in 539 BC. And as you'll remember from several weeks ago in the sermon entitled Times, Dates, and whatever it was the title. Anyway, you remember that. Can't even remember my own title, but anyhow, I'm trying to close up here. As you'll remember from Daniel 7 and verse 23, before Nebuchadnezzar went into his beast-like form, and Daniel said, Babylon is fallen, but there was a band put around that tree so that it would limit its growth, but the roots and the stump remain. Remember? So if you'll remember the meaning of times, and seven times are mentioned here that band would be on that tree, and that tree was Babylon, and it fell in 539 BC. And if you extrapolate that out to all of the things that we said several weeks ago, or that I said, you come up with 360 days times seven, which is 2,520 years in which that band would be around that tree. And Babylon would be fallen as a system. Three times in the Bible, Isaiah 21 and verse 9, Revelation 14 and verse 8, and Revelation 18 and verse 2 show that Babylon is fallen, fallen, which indicates that it will fall once again. The Babylon of the end time is the revival of the Holy Roman Empire, which should be clear by now. And it's going to fall once more. But we have no idea what happened in the year 1981. Gene Hogberg wrote to us. He was really good at world events. And he wrote to us and kind of speculated as to what might be the occurrence in 1981, 82 that would be of interest and signify the growth of this tree or this system of Babylon in that time period. He pointed to a Pope speech, Pope John Paul II, Europe, reclaim your roots. He said that in Spain at one time. Nothing really happened, and it hasn't happened, and it's been a long time since then. A long, long time. So we don't know if anything happened at that time, but what if this person called the Beast, what if he was born in 1981? Now, I have nothing to base that on. And as I said, it is pure, mindless, idle thoughts and speculation. So don't write it in the margins of your Bible. But I will say this. That person would be 38 years old, 39 years old at most right now. But I'm not going to try to isolate in Germany all of the live births that occurred in Austria, Germany, Hungary in the year 1981, specifically drill down to the males and then identify further out of 40 million people or so who the beast might be in the future. But until that time, we might expect the coming beast, the last revival of the Holy Roman Empire, to be a student of classical Rome, one who will be able to exploit a crisis situation, likely of Germanic descent, and one who will collaborate with the Roman Catholic Church. This person, this man, has not appeared on the scene yet, but he very well may be alive now. And at about this time in Europe, if he's alive, he's about to go to bed. Brethren, let's watch and be prepared spiritually so that we ourselves are ready for the coming future events.